of that Indo-Iranian steppe people moved into India, the so-called Aryans or Indo-Aryans. They overthrew or assisted in ending. I think they really overthrew the Indus Valley civilization known in archaeology, called by the Sumerians Malua. There are faint memories of this in the Rig Vedas. And they moved into the land of the five rivers of the upper Indus and then into the Ganges and became the people who will eventually fuse with the local populations to create classic Indian civilization. And so these movements in what we call the early Iron Age from about 1000 to 500 BC had major, major consequences for the development of civilization in the Near East and India, and as we'll see in an upcoming lecture, in China as well. And it tied together the whole of the steppes with this cultural koine, with this common way of life, which would come to dominate the steppes through all of antiquity and only change in the 6th century AD with the arrival of the Turks. Now, our goal is to see the implications of these changes on the steppes in the coming lectures. It is people from the steppes who are responsible for important exchange of technology and cultural ideas that will help stimulate early Chinese civilization, or at least enrich it, to be more accurate. Much of Chinese civilization will be sui generis, but there will be an important component there. Their very pressure on the empires of the Near East and the empires of the Mediterranean will lead to major confrontations and changes in the great Persian Empire, in the Empire of Alexander the Great, and ultimately in the successor states of the Roman Empire and the Parthian states that follow those empires. And so the plan now is to move our focus from the original homeland of the Indo-Europeans on the Pontic Caspian steppes east to those steppes of what are now Mongolia, to look at how these Iranian and Tocharian nomads come into contact with China, their interaction, and what those repercussions will be like across the central and western steppes and for the great civilizations bordering them.
Lecture 3, Early Nomads and China.
In this lecture, I wish to deal with early nomadic peoples and early China. The interaction is extremely important, and you might ask why we start with China. Part of it is because we have extremely good records, and we have earlier records of the interaction of steppe peoples with settled peoples. We'll be talking about them later, but the Chinese records are particularly good. The second important point is, as I mentioned at the close of the last lecture, that we will start looking at the migrations of peoples from east to west. The earliest populations moved from the Western steppe zone out. These would be Iranian speakers. And DNA has increasingly confirmed that nomadic peoples who would have dwelled on the western and northwestern frontiers of early China were in origin probably Indo-European speakers, Tocharian languages, which came to be very important in the Tarim Basin, or Iranian-based languages. And so we start with China for those two reasons. The interaction between the steppe nomads and the Chinese led to very important changes, very important repercussions, and it will then result in movements of people east to west, really till the end of the course. Another reason why I choose to deal with China is not only are the records very good, the records allow us to look at the first significant conqueror of the steppes, who will be featured later in this lecture. His name is Modu Chanyu. That's a Chinese rendition of his name. He is the leader of the Xuannu, and he in many ways is the prototype for many of the conquerors better known to you as Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane. And so starting with early China and the nomads is really a good point to tie together key themes of the entire course, as well as this new movement now that goes from east to west. Well, I mentioned that DNA and archaeology has indicated that nomadic peoples dwelling on the western and the northwestern frontiers of China This would be in the region of Gansu, the corridor that links China to the Tarim Basin, to the Ordos Triangle. And you have to think of the Yellow River as this vast river that bisects northern China, and it loops up. It starts in the Tibetan highlands, it loops around, and in that loop is a very arid zone, very attractive to nomadic peoples, not very attractive to agriculturalists. Chinese emperors are always concerned about controlling it because it's part of the river valley of the Yellow and therefore essential for protecting their capitals, Anyang, Luoyang, and later capitals of the Tang period. So the archaeology and DNA indicates Chinese urban civilization, which was based on the cultivation of millet in the Yellow River Valley and the cultivation of rice in the Yangtze, or as it's now generally rendered, the Yangtze, that these urban centers, these early settlement regions, were in constant contact, a very important contact, with nomadic peoples. I should make a note that in the course of talking about China, I will tend to use the new system, the pinyin system. I was actually trained on an older system of Chinese transliteration, that is the so-called the Wei Jilis system. And sometimes I kind of mix the two systems in my pronunciation, so please forgive me if that happened. Yangtze is the common way it's rendered now. Yangtze is the more traditional way that I know and many English speakers still use. What the archaeology shows us is that Chinese civilization was subject to outside influences in its formative period. Now, this does not mean that the Chinese were not original. This does mean that the Chinese themselves apparently learned the cultivation of rice very early, mastered the cultivation of millet, developed important settlements, and also the architecture that comes to characterize early China, this rammed down or earth construction, where you put wooden frames, you ram down the earth, you use them as platforms to build palace structures. We see that as early as the Sui dynasty, roughly around 2000 BC. It's later used in the construction of the Great Wall and other types of features. Chinese civilization stretches way back into the Neolithic with the domestication of animals and plants. It develops a distinct urban literate civilization. On the other hand, what the archaeology proves is that this civilization, however, owed some very important gifts from the nomadic peoples. This has come from tombs, particularly. One of the major items that have been found in tombs of the early period, particularly of the so-called Shang dynasty, traditionally the Shang are dated as starting in 1766 BC. Many scholars would date that now a little later, around 1600 BC. But in the Shang, and in the earlier period, generally known as the Sui or Shua, it's sometimes rendered as HSXIA is now the common way of rendering it. In these dynasties, jade and other objects have been imported from the Tarim Basin, which is a considerable distance away. You have to go across that corridor through the so-called Jade Gate, the great pass that links China to the outside world. Clearly, there was some kind of trade connection bringing the goods in. Another important point is the appearance of chariots and horses and wheels, especially spoked wheels. These are particularly characteristic of the Shang period. Chinese warfare is very much based on chariot warfare. Yet the technology, even some suspect some of the words, are clearly not originally Chinese. The knowledge of horses, the wheel, the light chariots, was due to trade or some kind of contact with nomads, and these would have been Indo-European speakers, probably Iranian and Tocharian. There's arguments that copper and bronze technology may have been transmitted by the nomadic people from the Near East to China. Even more controversial is the notion of the writing. We have in this early period of Chinese civilization, early writing, oracle bones used in divination, particularly from the Shang period. There is also later bronze tablets from the so-called Zhou dynasty that follows. They are ideograms. Some scholars claim that these early forms of Chinese writing could be read in as many as six different languages. Again, a very controversial point. Did the Chinese invent writing completely on their own? We don't have evidence of that. We don't have early developments from pictures to writing. The system as we have it is full-blown. That might be a result of the fact that we don't have the earlier examples, the way we have in Sumer, where we can see how you go from pictograms, essentially pictures, to full writing. Or the idea of writing might have been another one of those gifts, compliments of the nomads, brought to China, and the Chinese had an idea of writing and then put together their own writing system. Now, this is a very controversial and sensitive point. There really is not enough evidence to decide one way or the other. What is key, though, is that Chinese civilization was the product of a number of different peoples, early Chinese civilization, and that nomadic peoples, later known as the Yue Zhi, or the ancestors of the Kushans, the Wu Sun, and above all, the Shun Nu, or Shuang Nu, who may really have been pronounced Hunna, according to one argument, hence Huns, that these people had some sort of contact. We also know that there were periodic burnings of books. The first emperor, as opposed to a king in China, the first emperor we know about, Xin Shi Huangdi, who unifies China in the so-called Xin Empire from 246 to 206 BC, he ordered burning of the books. And one speculation is that he was essentially centralizing the cultural and aesthetic traditions of his empire on Chinese, and other languages were to be removed. And the notion of an unbroken succession of Chinese dynasties stretching back to the very origins of the heavenly kings is really a historical conceit created in the Han period and later. That is the first great imperial dynasty of the 3rd century BC. And the notion that Chinese history has always been an unbroken succession of rulers, and that disunity, when it comes, is an aberration, it's not the norm, it's being done by non-Chinese bozos, I mean barbarians, whatever the stereotype, that this is a conceit that is imposed on the earlier period. And the archaeology suggests that it was much more complicated than what we have in the written tradition later on, starting in the Han and later. The other important point is that these early Chinese rulers, especially the later Shang and the emperors of the so-called Zhou or Zhou dynasty, again, it could be rendered as CH or ZZH, depending on which transliteration system you're using, that they became quite alarmed that they had to deal with various nomadic peoples. And these nomadic peoples, somewhere around 1000 BC, had clearly learned the art of horseback riding with the mounted saddle and the composite bow. The nomadic peoples dwelling on the northern and western frontiers of the Chinese world are not very well known to us. We don't have any written texts. Well, we have a few texts later of the Shuang Nu, and they're very controversial. But we really don't know what languages they're speaking. The best guess is on the western side, there were Tocharian speakers, and they would be the Yuzi, the later Kushans, a people who will migrate eventually into India, or the Wu Sun. Some have tried to identify them with Iranian speakers, including Alans. And then to the north, we encounter a bewildering array of names, the Chang, the Ti peoples. These are names that start appearing in the 8th and 7th centuries BC. And finally, in the 3rd century BC, we hear largely of the Shuang Nu. And the Shuang Nu become the barbarians par excellence that concern the early Chinese emperors. The Shuang Nu, our best estimation is, they spoke an Altaic language. Now, I spoke of the Indo-European language families. And the Indo-European language families had broken up in very, very early times, distributed themselves across Eurasia and Western Europe, and really broke up into a large array of different languages mutually unintelligible. The Altaic language family consists of several branches. The two most important branches in this course will be the Turkish languages and the Mongolian languages. Those two languages and their daughter offspring languages are much, much closer to each other than any of the Indo-European languages. And they diverge much later. And the suggestion is that in the early Iron Age, from a 900 to, say, 300 BC, The speakers of what eventually became Turkish and Mongolian languages were dwelling on the Mongolian steppes bordering the Manchurian forest zone. And these are the people who come into contact with the Chinese. They've learned the pastoral nomadic way of life from the Iranian nomads immediately to the west. And that's, again, a very important point I wish to stress. There was undoubtedly intermixture, intermarriage, a swapping of ideas. And these nomadic peoples do not see themselves as Indo-European speakers versus Altaic speakers. They think in terms of tribe and clan. And tribe and clan can expand and incorporate newcomers. The people can be assimilated. The Chinese found all of these people alarming. And in the early Iron Age, China was a series of competing states. Whoever the early Zhou rulers were who succeeded to the Shang, they broke up into what are known as the Warring States. The states of Yan, of Xiao, Wei, Qin, all of these vied for power in the heartland of China, which is essentially between the Yellow River and the Yangtze, or Yangtze, if you wish to call it that. The region where the heartland of the cities, the agricultural wealth is located. That is the heartland of the classic Han Chinese. Everything else is extension. And as these states battled for supremacy, they were far more concerned about their Chinese neighbors. Nonetheless, the northern states could not neglect their frontiers. And already, as early as the 6th century BC, some of these states were building walls along their northern frontier to protect themselves from these horse-riding nomads. Well, an important change comes in the middle of the 3rd century BC. In 246 BC, one of the contenders, the king of the state of Qin, and that can be rendered as either CH or X in the current transliteration system, Qin Shi Huangdi. Well known to many people because in 1974, his mausoleum was found and we got thousands of the famous ceramic army. We actually have some examples of them here in miniature, which represents the army of the first real emperor of China as opposed to a king, a man who could rule the whole Chinese heartland and had wider ambitions in the frontier zones. He had interned with him this essentially personal army, which is actually a very good look at the type of armies that the Xuannu encountered in their wars, especially in the 2nd century BC, which we'll talk about in an upcoming lecture. Well, anyway, Qin Shi Huangdi unites the various states of China into the First Empire. He has essentially control of China and the urban civilization. He was a hard master. He carries out the burning of the books, as I said. He ruthlessly reorders Chinese civilization, following what is often known as legalist principles. Legalism was one of the philosophical systems that emerged in the period of Warring States, along with Confucianism and the more spiritual, mystical Taoism. He ruthlessly mobilized labor. And above all, he had imperial ambitions. In contrast to many later Confucian emperors, Qin Shi Huangdi put military success at a high level. Now, Chinese expansion was in different directions. To the northeast, towards Manchuria, Korea. To the south, to control, of course, the regions we now know as Vietnam. But foremost in concern was that northern frontier, and above all, the Xuannu of the Xuannu. And the Xuannu is apparently some kind of royal title. And the first one we hear of is a man named Tuman. Tuman apparently organized the various clans. They probably included people of different language backgrounds, not only Altaic speakers, true Xuannu, but other associated tribes. And you have to get used to a policy that occurs in both Turkish and Mongolian tribal structures. Later, it's put very simply, any tribal coalition on the steppes consists of two components. There are the inner tribes. Those are the real tribes of the original confederation, usually speaking the same language or very closely related languages. And then there are the outer tribes. These are tributary and allied tribes affiliated to the Xuannu. And it's always very nice in steppe nomad society. You really know whether you're in or out. If you're in the inner tribe, you're in on the really good goodies. You're going to get the first pick of the loot. In the case of China, that means silks and other goodies. When you're on the outer tribes, you're in a vassal relationship. Some of them can be promoted, some can be demoted. But this sort of organization is first perceived under Tumon, and then, when he dies, under his son, Modu Chanu, the successor. Both of these two kings are known from Chinese sources. The rendering of their names is from the Chinese characters, but what we can say is that they posed enough of a threat that the Qin emperor commissioned his general, Meng Tiang, one of the very able generals of early China, to deal with the nomads. And we see in this first expedition a typical pattern that emerges. That is, what does an organized state, an organized bureaucratic state, the first Chinese emperor, expect victory to be? The general, Meng Tian, is ordered to pursue the nomads north. And he does. He leads an enormous army up the valley of the Wang Ho. He tries to drive them out of the Ordos Triangle, then into the arid zones across the Gobi. And he counts success in the following way. Have we captured the Xuannu leader? Have we captured any kind of settlements? What areas can we mark off with a wall and bring in colonists, set up settlements, and tax them and declare a victory? And so his notion of victory is taking real estate on the frontier zones, marking it out, and defining the northern frontier as China and everything on the other side as barbarian land. Well, in that sense, the expedition is a success. And Meng Tian, who's, some of whose thoughts have survived to us, is apparently the general who ordered linking some of these walls together that became the basis of the Great Wall. Now, you have to actually deprogram yourself from thinking of what the Great Wall of China was like when it was built by Xin Shi Huangdi and his general Meng Tian. The Great Wall is not what you see today. What you see today is a monument built in the Ming period of masonry architecture, which is essentially an emotional overreaction to the fact that the Mongols had ruled China. And there's an old adage I remember when I was a boy starting to decide what field of history I would major in, and it went something like this. Rome fell because China built the Great Wall. Well, the Great Wall in the 3rd century BC was hardly anything like of what we think a Great Wall is today. It was rammed earth. That is, there's an earth platform built. It had, that's earth that's pounded down within a wooden frame. On top of it, there would be rough constructions. There would be wooden palisades. The wall wasn't really continuous. It'll stretch 2,500 miles, but there's sections of it where you use the natural boundaries of mountains. You construct it from wood and earth. The labor was from great corvées, that is, massing together peasants to build this thing. It is an immense testimony to the organization of early China, but it's nothing like a Maginot Line. It was intended to mark the boundary and operate as a frontier system to monitor and to regulate the movement of the Xuannu across the Chinese frontier. Because in the very costly expedition of trying to run these nomads down, the Chinese very, very quickly learned they don't have the horses to do it. One of the rude awakenings that Xin Shi Huangdi and the next set of emperors, the Han emperors, learn is Chinese horses are just not strong enough to be ridden. The soil in China does not have enough selenium that allows the horses to develop the kind of strong bones necessary to carry a mounted warrior. So Chinese chariots of 2 or 4 horses is the best you can do. And these are inadequate for fighting nomads on grasslands and arid conditions, the Mongolian grasslands, the Gobi Desert, the Ordos Triangle, or even that corridor of the Gansu that links China to the Tarim Basin. So from the start, the Chinese for the first time find themselves at a military disadvantage. Their heavy infantry, their crossbows, their chariots just are not going to bring a Xuannu army to battle, not very easily. And so what you do is you mark out a system of frontier fortifications that allow you to monitor and regulate, perhaps regulate trade. This policy will be inherited next by the Han emperors. And Xinshu Wandi, who was so successful in organizing the first Chinese empire, when he dies, does not leave a set of very, very successful successors. The dynasty is quickly replaced in 206 BC. At the same time, in 209 BC, shortly after the death of Xinshu Wangdi, he dies in 210 BC. In 209 BC, Modu Chanyu, the son of Tuman, comes to power in his own right. He had been in association with his father. He had racked up incredible reputation in raids and warfare, and he proved to be able not only as a commander, but also as an organizer. Modu Chanyu organizes the Xuannu into a great confederation of inner and outer tribes. He is served by two subordinates, the righteous king of the right, the righteous king of the left. You have to understand that when you're dealing with the Xuannu or later Turkish or Mongolian peoples, they see the world from the roof of the world. They are looking out on the map. They are not looking the way we do, projection north. They are at the north looking to the rim of the world. They are in the center of the known world. And the right to them is the west, the left to them is the east. And he had two subordinate kings with lesser kings, all of these people tied to the Chanyu, and in turn rewarded with plunder and booty. And that meant he could tie the tribes together. He also appreciated the advantages of Chinese civilization. The Xuannu used Chinese bureaucrats. They want trade goods. They develop a peculiar set of writing, which is still controversial as how to read it, but it's clearly in imitation of the Chinese. Some of their political institutions, such as the notion of the Mandate of Heaven, that too seems to be a borrowing from China, where the Chanyu is apparently the embodiment of heaven itself. And so there is an enormous amount of cultural exchange going in both directions, and those advantages allow the Xuannu to organize themselves much more successfully. There is always a weakness in these confederations, and that is in the nature of succession. Succession within nomadic states is generally lateral succession. That is, when a ruler dies, very often his brother succeeds rather than his sons. And this will cause repeated civil wars. A later one among the Xuannu that the Chinese exploit, you'll see the same when Attila the Hun dies in 453. You'll see the same after in the Great Mongol Civil War, which puts Kublai Khan on the throne. So there is always that danger of the confederation breaking up over the succession. But Modu Chanyu has the ingredients of success: organization, the welding of the great tribes, and raiding China. Now, the raids on China were never intended to overthrow the Chinese Empire. They put pressure on the Qin dynasty. It was a contributory factor to the fall of the Qin. But in 206 BC, a new man, Gao Zhu, who originally started off his career as a jailer under the Qin and turned rebel and eventually seized the throne and instituted in a civil war what we call the Han Dynasty. And the Han Dynasty is the quintessential Confucian state. The first emperor of the Han creates the Confucian order as we understand it. And that Confucian order will be articulated and improved.